Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, July 18th, 2003. Today's session is entitled, You Break It, You Buy It. Marriage, Family, and Friends. Session 4 of Poetry and the Healing Power of Salvage and Detritus. Presented by Steve Ringo. Number RIS 2003-04. Let's listen in.
Marriage, Family, and Friends. I'm Steve Ringo. Did I already say that?
No.
Burn it, Bob. And the overarching theme of the sessions is poetry and the healing power of salvage and detritus, which we've been kind of unpacking over the last three previous times together. I do have some slides that I'm going to show again tomorrow that I won't show today that we did look at on Monday about some of the which shows some of the things I've been making. And each time I've been doing the session, I've tried to bring in a few new objects of detritus from the upper level of the mind. So it doesn't have to be appealing to you, but maybe intriguing or a little bit curious might be the word. So come and look up later on if you want. This one actually is a magnet, so anything metal will be drawn to that one, which has its own symbolism, I suppose. But the main task is poetry. And on the first day, we talked a little bit about the three articles of the Creed as a framework for how to see some of these poems. Obviously, every time you read a poem, you bring your own biases and perspectives and experience and history to that poem. But I think poets realize that when they release the poem to you and to your mind and your heart and your faith, you do with it something that might be very different than whatever they meant. And sometimes poets come back to the same poem 10 years later and they think, wow, I saw something in there that I didn't know was there even 10 years later. Sometimes a poet, when you're writing a poem, goes that way. So that's a nice thing. That's a good kind of chemistry or spontaneity, serendipity, and rebirth of the words and the ideas and how life changes. The river keeps flowing, right, or the path. The title here today sounds a little frivolous or maybe has a little edge to it too, doesn't it? Marriage and Family and Friends. When you see this warning in a store, a retail establishment, what kind of trigger does that throw at you?
Be careful.
Be careful. Definitely. And I think the responsibility. So I put here a warning. This is a warning. Break it, you buy it. They really don't want to be mean, though that's the Nordstrom way would be to not even say that right. You break it, and we'll give you one. Kind of the Nordstrom way. But although that's changing too. The yellow light is flashing. Careful now, careful, caution. We don't want any trouble. But you buy it is the responsibility part. And I like to apply that to how we see each other in friendships, how we see each other in families, father, daughter, marriage. And did I say friendships? I think I did. And moving away in the healing sense of that, when we talk about the healing of the world, obviously, marriage, family, and friends is probably, for most of us, our biggest world, our most significant world, our primary universe. So if we can see and find ways for healing within that world, that's family and marriage and friends, and move away from the commodity kind of approach that a lot of the society sort of seems to treat relationships as, then maybe that promotes healing and promotes wellness in the whole world too, and kind of in turn a rippling effect. So keep those things in mind, and we'll read each poem as it is and hopefully have a little pleasure in doing that. Poetry should please the mind and the emotion. I think a good poem attracts the brain, has something to say as an idea, but also connects your feeling to that, maybe, or bridges the two in a fun way, or engaging way. The first poem is on the very first page, right? I always forget to number pages when I do these. invariable. So the one where it says Linda Paston, I think her book is here, right there. And these are all on reserve, so when we're done, I'll put them back in the library on reserve if you want to take a look at it. And if you come up and ask me to borrow it and take it to your room, then that's okay too. Just so I kind of know where it is. I'm not going to be, I'm going to be trusting, so that's good. People don't tend to steal poetry much. So I'll read this one, and later on as we go, I'll invite any of you to read if you wish, so think that over if that's an option for you. To a daughter leaving home. When I taught you at 8 to ride a bicycle, loping along beside you as you wobbled away on 2 round wheels, my own mouth rounding in surprise when you pulled ahead down the curved path of the park. I kept waiting for the thud of your crash as I sprinted to catch up, while you grew smaller, more breakable with distance, pumping for your life, screaming with laughter, the hair flapping behind you like a handkerchief waving goodbye. Other times together we've talked about what might be a key line for you. What is there a line that jumps out at you, or a key word that seems to catch your ear? Anybody want to take a shot at something, one little thing? Yeah.
It's actually the phrase, smaller, more breakable, mm-hmm. with distance.
Mm-hmm. Can you say a little more about that, or why?
Sure. At the age where I have a 20-year-old daughter,
mm-hmm.
and that's kind of the feeling that it evokes at times,
okay.
because they're, not that she wasn't independent before, but there's much more independence.
Mm-hmm.
And then you move into the, almost the reconciliation of screaming with laughter,
yeah.
hair flapping behind you like a handkerchief waving goodbye.
Yeah.
It's just a...
Yeah, there's a happy sadness, kind of a mixed set of feelings, huh? What is the final mood or tone, you think?
Some remorse in a way, but at the same time you're thinking,
yeah.
hey, this is a good thing.
Ambivalence maybe, huh?
I don't know if it's ambivalence, but oh gee.
Right.
Goodbye. Godspeed.
Pride.
What can I do?
I was gonna say pride.
Pride too,
yeah.
Yeah,
I think so.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I like what you touched on, Jerry, about the smaller, because she's getting smaller in her eyeball, right? As the bicycle pulls away on these 2 round wheels on the bike, and then what mirrors the round wheels is, oh no! You know, the mouth goes round when the wheels are going round, and then she's going away. I mean, she's getting smaller only in the eyeball because she's really getting bigger. So this irony of bigger, smaller, going away, diminished to her, bigger to the world, bigger to herself. There's a few little moments of fear there too, fright that she's gonna fall, the thud, the crash, and where she breaks the lines, like you said, Terry, more breakable, slap, break line, break with distance, screaming, break line, break with laughter. I think it has a sweetness, but I don't think it's sappy.
No.
Maybe anybody think other thoughts on this poem?
It paints a nice picture. You can
yeah.
clearly see it as you read.
I agree. Very visual.
Mm-hmm.
A little snapshot.
Mm-hmm.
Small snapshot of a big thing, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
It's a very big thing. To a daughter leaving home, so when we just finish.
Sorry, we're late.
Oh, that's fine. I'm glad you're here. The next, would someone like to read Imperative by Scott Cairns? It's in this book, I believe.
I'll read this.
Okay.
The thing to remember is how tentative all of this really is. You could wake up dead. Or the woman you love could decide you're ugly. Maybe she'll finally give up trying to ignore the way you floss your teeth when you watch television. All I'm saying is that there are no sure things here. I mean, you'll probably wake up alive. And she'll probably keep putting off any actual decision about your looks. Could be she'll be glad your teeth are so clean. The morning could be full of all the love and kindness you need. Just don't go thinking you deserve any of it.
That's good. Thanks, Mark. Talk to me about this one. What do you like, or what comes at you in your thinking or your feeling process?
I think the first sentence puts it into perspective. The first of the, mm-hmm. well, the thing to remember is how tentative all this really is. It mm-hmm. kind of gives you an image of something fleeting. You could yeah. wake up one day and things could go either
yeah.
way.
Yeah.
Your life could be. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And bridged with the title, I think that mm-hmm. as a starting point for the poem, that's a good observation that he starts there, how tentative all of this really is. And then he kind of, so that's big, and then he starts to narrow it down. But that is his starting point.
Well, the only non-tentative thing is death.
Yeah?
That's.
Mm-hmm.
And I love how he just lays it out. You can wake up dead. You can wake up dead. Well, that's all I guess. Yeah. So.
Sounds like a country song, kind of. There's an old Robbie Robertson song where he was out, I could wake up in the morning dead.
That struck me because I don't usually think of being dead as waking up.
Yeah. Right.
Waking up alive, yes.
I was sitting in the library, so I wouldn't be late. Is this the one from last time? I wanted the one from last lesson, too. You don't have
it. I don't have it right here, but I will get you one. Have I been telling you that for 2 days now?
Thank you.
That's the one for today, though.
Okay.
Keep going. Stanza 2. The woman you love could decide you're ugly. It gets kind of brutal that right after death you could be ugly, right? So if you woke up and you're not dead, well, maybe you're ugly. Maybe she'll finally
get out of annoying habits.
Was it, yeah.
Yeah. But isn't this the stuff of marriage or friendships or intimate partnerships? I think it just plain is.
That's why we all snickered. Uh-huh.
Yeah. And then in the third stanza, kind of breathes a little. He lets you breathe a little and take a, okay, exhale. I mean, you'll probably wake up alive, but you'll probably be all right with your looks. And maybe he's good. He gets real utilitarian. Maybe she'll like you because your teeth are so clean. And full of all love and kindness. The clincher again comes back to what you touched on in the title and the imperative, the tentative. Don't go thinking you deserve any of it. Any of it. Right? So the all of the first line, the any of, is very it's imperative. It's kind of a command or an imperative to live and to live fully and to take it as gift, I think. Each other and the days we have, the looks we have, the breath we have when we're not dead, those things. Other thoughts on this one?
Well, I like the juxtaposition of death and love, these big, huge things, and then flossing your teeth. And,
yeah.
And that's human life too. Mm-hmm. All these minute, trivial things that we make huge decisions about in some ways, sometimes.
True.
And yet we're all living with love and, or the lack of love, death, fear of death.
Yeah. And it's what we pretty much all really want is acceptance, genuine acceptance.
Yeah.
What
a great last one.
Yeah, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Theology of grace there. I think there's in this a sense of combating that notion of entitlement too, mm-hmm. that in marriage or friendship or just in life, there's a lot of entitlement mm-hmm. that seems to go around in our culture. And he's saying, no, you know, you're not entitled to that. This is something that's given and it's kind of sacred, I think. Even though it's all this practical, floss, ugly question, and closer to death. Next page, another one for the daughter. Terry, how old's your daughter that you were touching on?
20.
That's the age. Yeah, has this been building up or is it?
Only since about 8.
No,
she's a independent young lady.
Good.
But still needs mom and dad on occasion. So.
Yeah.
Wow. I'm about 2 years behind you there, so.
Someone want to read this one? Poem for a daughter? Okay.
Poem for a daughter. When you were born, you were like a cluster of small flowers in summer, petals the delicate color of sun on a river, hints of red carp below, something just visible, life within you, feeling out to the new planet. Come, my love, before you learn the word of love, before you open in the sun. It is morning and the sun is a ripe melon. There is such a festival in your body that I wonder if you hear the summer, sharp taste of lemons, skin of a petal, and deep in the river of your blood, whole generations singing.
It's a father to a daughter, right? He addresses it to her, right? So it's intimate that way. We're allowed to kind of overhear the intimate words to a daughter. What do you make of that, or think of it, or feel?
Well, most of the things, the images that he uses are those almost mundane, almost trite, and yet they're so mysterious, mm-hmm. You know, like a cluster of small flowers.
Right.
Yet who really understands about mm-hmm. flowers?
Sure.
Other than at a superficial level.
Right.
And something just visible, life within you, feeling out to a new planet.
Mm-hmm.
What a great line.
Yeah, it is.
But I'm not sure what it means.
Yeah.
But that is what it is.
Yeah. I think there's an interesting sexual undertone here too that is cool because you don't hear that very often from a father for a daughter. It's hard to say. Come, my love is a very it could be right out of the romantic English British poets to a beloved, which is a daughter, right? But he's bold enough to use that to his daughter, not just in a traditional, typical romantic way. Before you learn the word love, before you open in the sun, I think it's a sexual. It's got to be
coming of age.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then the next stanza: it is the morning, and the sun is a ripe lemon. There is such a festival in your body. There's all these things happening in her body that I wonder if you hear the summer sharp taste and what's going to come. You know that this is it's joyful. It's amazing, it's powerful, but there's going to be bitterness and sharpness and danger and the summer, the dryness of summer and all those other things, parched of body and mind when she travels through this part of this time of coming of age, I guess it is. But, and then even further still and deep in the river of your blood, whole generations. The seeds that are, the eggs that are waiting to be born, whole generations. It's powerful. For you, anybody?
Strong invitation. It's an invitation that you may not really want to say.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you need to
step out.
But it still has to be there.
Yeah.
Boy or girl, but it's still, you need to realize and come. And here's your invitation from your father.
Yeah,
that's just a. Yeah. And I really like the whole generation singing because it mm-hmm. it brings it back to family in a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
And
unifies.
And unifies the whole series.
Yeah. Good.
one of the tugs is, you know, especially when you're coming of age, sort of, you're looking for your voice, your song, or my voice, my song. It's a more individual striving. And then with age, I've come to accept more that my voice is part of generations that have come before me, and that my place in that corporate song is more interesting to me now than my own song was.
I like the way you said that. That's nice. Made me think of sheets of music, for like what composers do with a whole page is one whole moment, you know.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And it's you can read it, and else I think it's, I can't even start. But that one part, you know, this is my note line there in the whole. But it's hard to see until you get a little more time between to. Distance to see it. It's too close.
Mm-hmm. I wonder also if it could be the father trying to give that foundation to the daughter that, you know, I know that you're going to go out and you may be hurt and you will grow and you're, you know, but within your blood is the whole generation singing, and so we're there, you know, and you know we're there behind you and as a foundation. So as you go out,
that's good.
We're still there.
I like what you said too, Jean, about the trite. There is a sort of a triteness to this, because so many people have tried, everybody tries to do this, and not everybody, but it's been so often tried. And I thought of somebody who's non-poetic, but Bill Cosby, in a book he wrote about fatherhood, where he has a chapter about how absolutely clueless every father is, because, and I suppose mothers, I can't really say, but because you get this baby, and you can read everything. You can read all the books and all the manuals, but it's one of those things you cannot really teach anybody. You got to just learn it. You probably learn a few things, but you just sink or swim, and there's no book, there's no 3-week training that's going to do it. And you know, we all want to say these things, and parents all want to get that out there and learn it. Everyone's just stumbling out there and limping along, kind of blindfolded.
Well, the way he starts out describing this, starting with a cluster of small flowers, then it's the color of sun on the river.
Yeah.
Which is much, much more massive and suggestive. A lot more suggestive, but it's the bigger thing. And then it's feeling out to a new planet.
Right.
The immensity and the hugeness and the profound thing that's happening is, as he's saying, just getting bigger and bigger as he realizes.
Yeah.
Maybe we don't know who's coming of age this is.
Well, and I love that. Oh, I'm sorry. I love the line, "Come, my love, before you learn the word love."
I know.
Yeah, that's.
Yeah. I like that too. Well, let's move to the next one. Swedish poet Lars Norén, translated by American Gunnar Harding. "Today, everything is earnest and hushed, as at the death of a queen, when the radio changes from light music to Mozart or Bach. I don't know why, since she isn't listening. I can almost see how people leave each other, how silence works in the fading fabrics, and how the solitary gray wasp gropes its way into its death sleep in the wound of the dry mountain tree." It's a sad poem, I think, or melancholy. What do you make? Just your first impressions.
Well, the colors are certainly different.
Right. And the sounds are kind of
fading fabrics. Gray wasp.
Kind of deathly. The death of the queen is matched to the music, the light music, the way the radio changes.
there's, I like the radio, the way he worked that in there, and the, it's different than if it were the TV.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But he doesn't indicate why this is such a sad day. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot omitted. I think he gives you a sparse text to work with. I think the key is the three lines, I can almost see how people leave each other.
Mm-hmm.
I think so. Almost. There's so much that's gray and hidden and so much ambiguity and so much that's hushed and unspoken and uninterpreted and not even listening. If you're not even listening, you're interpretation is going to be even harder, huh?
A lot of finality of the last
it
line.
Is.
That's.
I agree. It reminds me in some ways of the tentative thing that Scott Cairns was talking about in that other poem that we looked at, The Imperative. How it's all so tentative, but this doesn't have the hope, I don't think. Yeah. Let's go to the next one then. Actually, we'll go to Rogan and skip Bretti for a moment. How can you do that? Skip Bretti. Are you mad at me? No. Somebody want to read the creed for Tuesday?
You're not going to do Rothke's?
Pardon?
You're not going to do Rothke's poem?
He might come back.
Oh.
You might.
I think I want to wait on it.
All right, okay.
The two in a row that are kind of more melancholy, I think we need to find a little bit more verve, so. But your comment is duly noted. A creed for Tuesday? I'll read it. A creed for Tuesday. Because it is not possible to slice a piece of cheese to its infinite point, because my eyes relay the inverted image of paper and pen, because my geranium turns furred leaves toward the sun, because I think of you and the phone rings, and you speak my name. Because the alternative is cacophony, I believe that we are more than the sum of our parts. The creed word is interesting, I think, in the title. And it's Tuesday, some fairly ordinary day, maybe. The cheese is kind of ordinary. Infinity is a big question, right? What's she talking about? Her eyes, this inverted image.
That's
yeah.
That's the way
it is. Yeah, it's an upside down thing. It's like a slide projector, you gotta turn it in. I can't never quite explain that very well, but I believe it in my creed. Geraniums, that's a mystery, isn't it? Not just the fur of leaves part, but the turning toward the sun. How do they do that? Kind of a miracle. And then it comes down to, because I think of you, there's the relationship here to somebody. And the phone rings when you speak my name. What do you make of that?
There is a strong connection between two people that is not every day, but there is that kind of psychic connection.
The spirits are.
But once in a while, it surprises me.
Yeah. Or the yearning is so strong that maybe just in the volume of time, it even intersects to connectedness in whatever way we want to explain that. But the alternative to that
is what? Cacophony. Crazy noise. Multitudes of voices. And then the last, where do you go with that last stanza? How does your brain sculpt at that?
I'm asking myself, is he saying we as human beings, or is he saying we as you and I? You who call it?
Probably both. I think initially the two beloved.
Mm-hmm. Well, something mechanical like this is the sum of its parts.
Right.
If a part is missing,
darn
thing doesn't go. But humans somehow are more than just our parts. But I don't think anyone has ever explained it to
me. Maybe we can. Maybe that's what people try to do. In the other poem we looked at, they're not trying to explain that, or in the poem for the daughter.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh, I love the way you hooked up with that. That's a great way to explain it. It's not, well, although Wallace Stevens would say that in our imagination we make that much more than it is. But then it's beyond the object, isn't it? And William Carlos Williams, the same thing. The thing itself, all that whole poetic and imagination and philosophical things, is much explored. But I love that, the way you said it, the way it connects to this, that we are the sum of our, we are much more than that. And then, like Christine said, with the voices of the river, or what, not the river, but the generation singing, where was that? Yeah, in Poem for a Daughter. Deep in the river of your blood, whole generations singing. And that being a huge, uncountable kind of, the word sum wouldn't even apply. You couldn't add it up. Let's go to the next one, two versions. Anybody? Sure.
One is older than the other. This they both know. In addition, they know what they want, which has always included each other. But one says, I want more. More than what the other says. You know, says the first, so much responsibility, the other says. What responsibility? We're not getting any younger. We need to decide. The other picks at a thread. They keep going over the future in two versions. In the first, one can decide what's needed, define the terms. In the other, life is pledged to the well-being of another, unformed and vaguely like oneself. And when they speak to each other, they don't discuss what they see playing like movies separately in their heads. One keeps saying, I want more. And the other keeps responding, yes.
Okay. If you apply this to a relationship, which I think it is, one is older than the other. This they both knew. In addition, they know what they want, which has always included each other. It infers that maybe that's changing, right? But one says, I want more. Then the dialogue begins, and the word responsibility occurs a few times. We're not getting any younger, harks back to the first line, one is older than the other. I think you could call this a prose poem, too, by the way. We need to decide. Is that sort of, that's that imperial we, or is that the truly mean we? And how does a we decide? You know? Because decisions. Can that be a thing where we do it? I don't know.
Then. Well, it's in the first, one can decide what is needed, define the terms. The other person, life is pledged to the well-being of another, unformed and vaguely like oneself, which we assume was
a future generation.
Or a child.
So I'm not sure how to read this. I thought for a while it was like husband and wife and they're ready to retire. Not, there's all that thing about spending my children's inheritance and that the program. And then there's the other side that wants to leave something for the children. But I think there's something more in here than that. Like,
yeah. I almost see it. I tend to agree as I'm reading through it that I think it may be a marriage kind of a relationship, or certainly, you know, a very close friendship kind of relationship where one is ready to move forward. The other has been satisfied with serving the needs and staying up and is not necessarily maybe ready to move on or not as supportive. I see a little bit of conflict in that.
But
what will bring us happiness? I think they're saying it.
Well, I'm not sure that this is telling them what's bringing happiness.
The implication for me is that what would make one happy isn't what would make the other person happy.
I agree with that. I agree.
But I'm not sure if I'm reading this.
I think it sets up the possibility that nothing is going to work out.
Yeah.
Or that it may not. It's back to that Scott Cairns thing of tentative. Maybe. But I think it's open. It's you can't nail it down.
Each one has a movie, and that's his head or her head. Another one doesn't see the same movie.
Mm-hmm. But isn't that always true?
Well, that's certainly common in a marriage.
Isn't it almost inevitable?
Mm-hmm.
And you hope that those movies can at least be communicated, and we communicate them so fallibly.
And maybe it's unfortunate that the second one isn't able to communicate what their movie is to the first. So it sounds to me like it's almost the silent partner, but they may be getting more frustrated as it goes on. And pretty soon there may be that break where if they had communicated better, they would have shared more.
Yeah, the one partner is watching this movie with popcorn and the other one miss and usually tell each other, well, my movies do. This is what's happening in my movie. This is what's happening, and kind of sharing enmity. Oh, watch my movie for a while here.
Mm-hmm.
But then when that starts to fade away, then what happens? One wants more. One's happy with the way things were.
Yeah.
Maybe they both were happy. The title appears right there in the middle. They keep going over the future in two versions. I don't think there's resolution, although the word yes at the end maybe is hopeful. I don't know. Sounds a little stuck.
It sounds a little stuck.
Yeah.
It sounds like it's an attempt to indicate understanding or acceptance, but you're not persuaded. The person's saying, I want more.
Yeah.
The other one says yes.
Yes, I want you to have more, but I don't know what the more is.
How to do it. Or the yes can be a tacit yes. I guess so, but I want more, but yes, I'll stick with you kind of thing. You know, which is sort of you're entering into that kind of illusion again. Then, is it really a yes, or is it a resignation? All waited out kind of yes. Who knows?
And there's also that implicit thing that if this is a married couple, children do direct what the family does.
Mm-hmm.
And then when that responsibility is gone, then you say, well, I always thought that when the kids were grown, we could do whatever it is.
Right.
What? Whatever made you think I'd have to do that?
Yeah. My son's up there, so. When the kids are grown.
I don't know if you're talking about.
I'll explain later. I'll try. I got this movie in my head. Let's move along. I want to skip Sylvia too, Jean, is that all right? For a second. And let's go to the middle pages where we have two poems by Sharon Olds. And we'll skip the third one of Sharon Olds and move on. Backward there. So, after 37 years,
My mother apologizes for my childhood. This is harsh stuff, isn't it? I knew when I set this up that this would be the toughest session as far as stirring that pot of, you know, family, marriage, and, you know, friend. What gets deeper or harsher or more important? You know, that's the reason it gets that way is because it's so crucial. So if it seems a little somber, I think I kind of expected that. I'm the kind of person that doesn't, you know, I want you to be happy too, so I'll see what I can do. But you knew this stuff was there too, it's no secret. And like we've talked about in worship the last several nights, and pain, suffering, the word healing wouldn't mean anything. If, you know, what would there to be healed if there weren't pain and suffering and loss and brokenness? Those things are part of life, so we do need to talk about it. Anyone care to read this one?
I'll read it.
All right.
After 37 years, my mother apologizes for my childhood. When you tilted toward me, arms out like someone trying to walk through a fire, when you swayed toward me, crying out you were sorry for what you had done to me, your eyes filling with terrible liquid like balls of mercury from a broken thermometer skidding on the floor. When you quietly screamed, where else could I turn? Who else did I have? The chipped crockery of your hands swinging toward me, the water cracking from your eyes like moisture from stones under heavy pressure. I could not see what I would do with the rest of my life. The sky seemed to be splintering like a window someone is bursting into or out of. Your tiny face glittered as if with shattered crystal, with true regret, the regret of the body. I could not see what my days would be with you sorry, with you wishing you had not done it, the sky falling around me, its shards glistening in my eyes, your old soft body fallen against me in horror. I took you in my arms. I said, it's all right. Don't cry. It's all right. The air filled with flying glass. I never knew what I said or who I would be now that I had forgiven you.
It's quite a dynamic in here. It's hard to unpack, I think. After 37 years, and then you don't hear about the forgiveness until the end, do you? The when in the very first line, when you, and builds up to the line in the very middle of the poem, when blah, 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 I could not see what I would do with the rest of my life. It's sort of the finishing thought of all the when this happened, when you. So that her life becomes thrown up in the air, kind of, what am I going to do? Something has changed. Talk to me now, too. I want to hear what you think of this. There's a reversal going on, isn't there?
Well, whether the mother deserves it or not, I think that we have all learned that we have to forgive. You know, whether, you know, maybe we don't know the specifics, but we've all, I think, experienced something similar to this.
Yeah.
And we can, in great righteousness, say, I'll never forgive you for what you did. Mm-hmm. That's not healing.
No. Scar.
And maybe it doesn't make any difference in the long run to the person forgiven, but it does make a difference to the one that can say, don't cry, it's all right.
The air filled with flying glass, the shattered crystal up above that, the sky splintering like a window, the shard.
Wonderful vocabulary.
Pardon?
Wonderful vocabulary. That
yeah.
Splintering, heavy pressure.
And she repeats shards. The sky falling around me in shards again.
It's like the whole, everything is broken. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's broken by this confession of forgiveness. Mm-hmm. There's a something that they've been living with for all this time that has built itself up into a solid structure, mm-hmm. and this breaks it all.
Yeah.
Scary as can be.
Yeah. But isn't there a healing?
Mm-hmm.
And the shards can almost be beautiful. Don't I see that? Maybe I'm mm-hmm. misconstruing that, but I see that the sky and the light and the shards become a thing of beauty, painful beauty, but sort of like the garbage type of beauty, or the broken pile, the pile of pain, the pile of lost hopes and all that, that can finally be redeemed and reclaimed by this apology, this 37. I wonder if the 37 is literal and, you know, it's a number that, isn't it a perfect number or a prime number? What do you,
prime,
that there's something about 37. It's got its own. Maybe not, but I kind of like to think that, who knows, that I'm always looking for symbolism. So.
And again, it's the last line, you know, I said, for who I would be
mm-hmm.
now that I have given.
Yeah, the future's up in the air, isn't it?
Well, so much of her identity
mm-hmm.
is tied up in not forgiving the mother.
Yeah.
So,
mm-hmm.
Who is she? She's got to let go of that.
Yeah. If something is broken,
yeah.
and it's good, but it's, whoa, now what?
Mm-hmm.
So the past stuff juxtaposed with this future that is very scary.
I think if it's 37 years of never having spoken to one another, no,
mm-hmm.
it's going to be different. Or if it's 37 years of having badgered one another,
mm-hmm.
or...
Yeah.
Or you tend to some of your relationship, and now it's time to do a new relationship.
I was going to say, or 37 years of just having buried it
mm-hmm.
and
sure.
and thinking, you know, pretending it's not there.
Right. Now, one thing we haven't touched on is that first half of the poem where the mother is really in images of death, that she's walking through fire, this mercury dripping from her, you know, on the floor, from her eyes under the floor. The screaming, the hand swinging, chopped crockery. She's like almost like the skin of a dinosaur or a cracked elephant's hide or something. Just seems like she's death-like. And coming to that point in life where the elderly become more like the child again. I can see some of that. Maybe I'm reading into it, but certainly she's driven by something in her life too that's driving her toward death, that pushes the need in her to apologize and to seek forgiveness, maybe.
Well, and that switch kind of is iterated again is when I say, it's all right, don't cry, it's all
right.
I mean, that
right.
is a motherly type of
right.
thing to say. That's
it is.
The, you know,
yeah. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. The reversal.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a wonderful healing in this that's maybe not wonderful in the sense of Hallmark, but wonderful in the sense of kind of genuine and got a bitter, harsh. And there's something there that we don't know about, but it was deep. It was,
yeah.
like you touched on, Gina, it's very deep. And we all have some of that. Every family has that. We all have our broken stories, larger, deeper rifts and pain, and small stuff too, the flossing of the teeth kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
When my son is sick, someone want to read that one, please. Thought of you and Olaf, Christine.
What?
I thought of you and Olaf when you were
oh, yeah.
hanging out the last
yeah.
few days.
That's right.
I'll read it. When my son is sick. When my son is so sick that he falls asleep in the middle of the day, his small, oval, hard head hurting so much he prefers to let go of consciousness, like someone dangling from a burning rope, just letting go of his life. I sit and hardly breathe. I think about the half-liquid skin of his lips, swollen and nicked with red slits, like the fissures in a volcano crust, down which you see the fire. Though I am down the hall from him, I see the quick bellies of his eyeballs jerk behind the greenish lids, his temples red and sour with pain, his skin going pale gold as cold butter, and then turning a little like rancid butter, till the freckles seem to spread black little islands of mold. He sleeps the awful sleep of the sick, his hard-working heart banging like pipes inside his body, like a shoe struck on iron bars when someone wants to be let out. I sit very still. I am out at the rim of the world, the edge they saw when they knew it was flat, the torn edge, thick and soiled black, the vessels and veins and tendons hanging free, dangling down. When my boy is sick, I sit on the lip of nothing and hang my legs over and sometimes let a shoe fall to give it something. Quite a bit of fear in there, isn't there? Seems kind of maybe exaggerated at times, but maybe not. When my son is sick, and you get the sense that this is a very sick a moment here, or time, period.
Almost like something has taken over his body because there's nothing warm and wonderful about it.
Maury, when you talked at the Bible study today about that captivity that the older, in the biblical times, that they would think of sickness as almost a demonic capturing of the body, or that we, in our medical knowledge, we know it's a virus, or we know it's a bacteria. It's not, I guess you could still link it to demonic, but we think of it as not moral, not other forces, it's nature. But she uses that language of captivity, that this sickness has him captive. Mm-hmm. I'm glad you touched on that.
Like a shoe getting the virus.
Yeah, prison. Pipes inside his body, like a radiator clattering.
And her helplessness. Mm-hmm. You know that great abyss?
Yeah.
Nothing. She could sit with her legs hanging over. And sometimes let a shoe fall to get at something.
Yes. What is that referring back to? Fall from.
There's no hope.
Mm-hmm. Right. Take my shoe, don't take my boy.
Right, yeah.
Like the power of.
Yeah. Well, there's a monster down there.
Huh? Yeah, on the edge of the world, off the ripped edge.
Yeah. My mind goes this way, and even when my sons are just a little bit sick, they fall. And I respond so much to the vulnerability of parents in their children.
Yeah.
She just keeps working that.
Yeah, she does.
Image of the edge they saw when they knew the world was Plato, they knew it was flat.
Yeah.
That's how far.
And then the word vessels, you almost picture these Columbus-like vessels.
Yeah.
But then it's blood vessels.
Yeah, right.
And veins and tendons hanging free, kind of like a chopped off limb almost.
Yeah.
And my boy is sick in the lip of the lip. There's back to his other lip in the earlier part of the poem. But this is the lip of that edge over which those monsters are sitting. And let the shoe, take the shoe, like you said, and let that. Kind of a little bit of that James Tate feeling that it goes to some other kind of realm of panic and imagination, but it's so real. It's such maybe Hitchcock almost, like that. But genuine that poetry can do like that, because that is real. It doesn't have to mean the world is flat, but I think what she means maybe there is how wrong our ideas about the world can be. For so many centuries, we thought it was flat. Now, what in this world I have right now, and with these people in my world,
what assumptions do I make about it all that are so long that 500 years from now, we, wow, people thought that, you know, can you believe it? Our mythology is so swallowed up, so deep. Other thoughts here?
That's just a wonderful job that you do. You know, it's just pulling you in, plugging you in. Horrid picture, the way she's painted it. It just bam, bam,
yeah.
Bam.
Yeah. And then there's kind of almost that sudden transition to back to when my boy is sick and helped.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Well, this brings a lot of emotion.
Mm-hmm.
It does. Which is really neat.
The warning, the responsibility that you touched on in the beginning, maybe, but the hope is...
And somehow it's the price we pay for loving someone, because
mm-hmm.
we may be sorry
mm-hmm.
for a friend who is ill,
mm-hmm.
but we don't trust her.
Yeah,
that's true. But only when you love
someone,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
we have to endure it.
Something different when it's a son or a daughter or a parent or...
And
yeah,
you love before they knew the word love.
I'll let you read the other Sharon Olds one on your own time. That's a good one, though. And then let's go to the very back page, and then we'll see if we can squeeze this one in with Seamus Haney. Snowbanks, North of the House. Fairly well-known poem from a book of Robert Bly's, and he actually picked a line from this poem for the title of his book of poems. The Man in the Black Coat Turns, the fourth line from the bottom, is the title of the book of poems. So we hold that line up. Kind of interesting. He spoke about this on public TV once and talked about his cabin up in the north woods of Minnesota and how this blizzard, he heard on the radio all the, you know, blizzard warnings that the radio gives. And this blizzard's coming through, and it's sweep through 6 feet of snow. But the amazing thing that triggered the poem was this blizzard stopped 6 feet away from his cabin. And he's musing on, why did it do that? You know, it's 300 miles wide, this blizzard. And for some reason, I was on the edge of this. Like when you're driving through Nebraska, and there's, you all of a sudden pass a cloud shadow, you know, 2 hours of clouds, and then now I'm out of it. Or those little moments, but anyway, that's where he started. Snowbanks, north of the house. Those great sweeps of snow that stop suddenly 6 feet from the house. Thoughts that go so far. The boy gets out of high school and reads no more books. The son stops calling home. The mother puts down her rolling pin and makes no more bread. And the wife looks at her husband one night at a party and loves him no more. The energy leaves the wine, and the minister falls, leaving the church. It will not come closer. The one inside moves back, and the hands touch nothing and are safe. The father grieves for his son and will not leave the room where the coffin stands. He turns away from his wife, and she sleeps alone. And the sea lifts and falls all night. The moon goes on through the unattached heavens alone. The toe of the shoe pivots in the dust, and the man in the black coat turns and goes back down the hill. No one knows why he came or why he turned away and did not climb the hill. The why question is unanswered, isn't it? He's simply raising the question, why do we stop reading books? Why did I stop reading poetry? Why did I start hating baseball 15 years ago and then come back to it, thankfully? Why does the mother stop loving her husband at that party? Why does the minister seem to falter about his faith, I presume? Why do we make these little moves? My sister and her family left today, and they were they're celebrating their 25th anniversary in about 3 days. And I just said to her, you know, you're the only one of the four of us that whose first marriage has lasted. All the rest of us have either been divorced or our second marriage. And she said, yeah, I wonder why, you know. Some of us just dumb luck, she said. Some of us, you know, those day-to-day decisions you make, but some of it, who knows? And I thought of this poem right away. Obviously, it was on my mind anyway, but when we first started today, the session, the morning light, you break it or you buy it. This is a warning. This is a flashing yellow light. Careful, because even these little shrubs, you turn away from your beloved just in a little shrug, you can create a new pattern. You can, by not even trying, we do these things where maybe you didn't really decide, but you defaulted. And what do they say? To not to decide is to decide. But major caution light. Be careful. Why did she stop baking bread? There's a lot of the cycle of life in here too, the sea lifting and falling, the endless repetition of life and death, and these decisions and these days that go by. Kind of Bergmanish, I think, if you're an Ingmar Bergman fan. There's something very Bergmanish about it. It's kind of a black and white poem. But if you were filming it, it'd have to be in black and white, I think. What do you think? Talk to me. It'll have to be done pretty quick.
This cabin is on the same lake that our cabin is on.
Oh, really? Capricorn?
Capricorn.
Wow, I didn't know that.
A lot of ministers up and down the shores there.
Yeah.
So that line struck me.
I love the way he talks about turning, 2 or 3 times the turning. The husband turns from the wife at this moment of grief in the coffin is there, and the man in the black coat at the end, he turns in the dust and he turns away, goes back down the hill. Remembering the poem about Mara yesterday and Lot's wife, and how she turned her back on her loved ones to go to those who needed rescuing. That turning, all these turns we do in life, to turn away or turn to, very careful we have to be, so careful. Morning.
Well, I had an additional response to the thing you said about the sea and the moon, that that's, they're kind of going on, indicating, I don't know, the immensity of time or something, but they don't have a stopping point. The sea just keeps on lifting and falling. The moon, though it waxes and wanes, it doesn't have an ending point like that sweep of snow stopping.
Right.
And these are things that come to an end.
Right.
And it just, I was seeing the contrast.
Yeah, that's good. Some way. I like the way you put it.
Because so many of these things are the human experience, that something comes to an end. Was that way in this game?
Wow, I like the way you juxtapose those.
It's kind of interesting, too. The first stanza ends with almost a little hope. Mm-hmm. It will not come closer. The one inside whose back and the hands touch nothing and are safe.
Yeah.
And you almost feel like, okay, but then at the very end, after the second stanza, you're just in much of a quandary of,
yeah.
And so you're not left with any resolution.
Yeah. Absolutely. It gets harsher.
Yeah.
Although if you see the connection between that, it will not come closer and the man in the black coat turns.
Turns.
Mm-hmm. That's a kind of ominous image. And if you're watching and he turns and goes away again, so some of these things that don't happen are good things that don't happen.
True.
And some of them are losses.
I thought the man in the black coat.
Well, we do have to call an end to this session, though. I invite you to study the other poems that we didn't touch on. And thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.